From KCRW in Santa Monica and KCRW.com, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
If you listen and learn, then you're going to be able to do anything you want next time.
Everybody thinks your business is really all white lights,
peaches and cream. What's with him?
Oh, I'm afraid he's gone Hollywood.
This week on The Business, a new book argues that media moguls act like spoiled brats, squandering the shareholders' money on toys that they don't really need. Plus, how do you create a TV spinoff that's original, but not too original? We asked the producer of the CBS shows NCIS and the brand new NCIS Los Angeles. But first, it's the Hollywood News Banter. Stay close. It's The Business from KCRW.
You can imagine Hollywood, everything is really driven by
making money.
What's with him?
Oh, I'm afraid he's gone to Hollywood.
I'm joined in the studio by The Business guest banterer, John Horn of the LA Times. He's recently back from Abu Dhabi and the Circle Conference. So, John, what is the Circle Conference?
It's a collection of Hollywood producers, executives, and a lot of Abu Dhabi money. They've got tons of oil money, and they're looking to invest it. In fact, they're investing hundreds of millions of dollars in Hollywood, and they're trying to create their own film economy. And their first investment in Hollywood hasn't been a home run. They were backers of Robert Rodriguez's Shorts, which kind of came and went in about a week.
Foreign money coming into Hollywood and being squandered is such a novel concept, John. It's never happened before.
And I think Abu Dhabi is going to show everybody how to do it right.
Oh, my God. That'll be such a breakthrough. So the movie was Shorts. And speaking of short, The Life of Southland, the John Wells-produced show, which was on NBC and was supposed to be on Friday nights at 9 o'clock, has been canceled before it could even have its second season premiere.
That's going to be a record, isn't it, for failure before you've even shown your new episodes?
I'm sure it's actually not, but in television where things get canceled fast. But it is kind of a remarkable thing for something that was very well reviewed and had some decent numbers, right, early on.
Yeah, and I also think what it shows is you have no time anymore. I mean, truly, the show was canceled before its premiere this season.
And they also have no time in terms of, you know, right. This is obviously a 10 o'clock show, and they have no 10 o'clock hour on NBC anymore.
Well, and when Jay Leno went on NBC, John Wells said, "Jay's a very nice guy, but I hope he falls flat on his face," and we get five dramas back. The sad news is Wells' show fell flat on its face, and those 5 hours are still with Jay.
Well, I don't know that anybody isn't on their face right now. And I don't even know if it's fair to say that Wells' show fell on its face when it may very well turn up on TNT or in cable. In fact, one of the Hollywood Reporter commented it would be dark day for Leno if that show ends up on cable and ends up outdoing Leno on a network, on a broadcast network.
Well, and their excuse, too, that the show was too gritty for 9 p.m. I mean, you could turn on, you know, the TV in 3 in the afternoon and see somebody knocking somebody's teeth out in mixed martial arts. So I don't know what the standards are anymore for what's too gritty and what's not.
Yes, it's
unclear what they mean by that. I think they just didn't want to pay for it.
And moving over to movies, we have a different kind of fight. Paramount has scheduled 2 DVD releases for less than the usual 3 months after their theatrical openings. And as you know, John, the movie theater owners, they are not happy.
They're rarely happy, but I think they're really upset about this. I mean, I think we're at a point where, and who knows if it's 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, 5 years out, where a movie is going to debut in theaters, on video on demand, on DVD, pay TV simultaneously. It's an artificial construct, this whole idea that you see a movie in a theater and then you have to wait 3 months for it to come on DVD. And I think Paramount realizes it, that there's an audience, and it never has made economic sense. You spend your $50 million in marketing to release the movie theatrically, and then you wait 4 or 5 months, and then you spend another $10, $20 million to do its DVD release.
Well, I think this is a very controversial, because a lot of the studios do have this theory, this belief that you do not destroy windows that pay by rolling back release dates. And, you know, with the big comic book movies being the kind of movies that people would be most likely to go to the theater to see, I think you're sort of doing this at your peril if you make the movie theater owners ballistic, as that was the word used by the head of the National Association of Theater Owners, John Fithian. They could punish Paramount when Paramount has a movie that needs to stay in theaters and would like to keep screens. And
that's true. But if Paramount does it, and Fox does it, and Disney does it, and Sony does it, and Universal does it, what are the theater owners going to do? And I think there's always going to be an audience theatrically for big event movies. But do you have to release? I mean, the other movie besides G.I. Joe, they're racing to video, is a movie called, what is it called, Kim?
It's called The Goods, Live Hard, Sell Hard.
You saw that movie three times. I know you love
that
movie.
But now
you can watch it 10 times on DVD.
I just keep repeating it in my Netflix queue, yeah.
But a movie like that, I mean, it doesn't even have any theatrical viability. So I agree that there's some movie that makes sense. But if all the studios say to the theater owners, you know what, it's not 3 months, it's 2 months, and then it's 1 month, there's really little they can do. What are they going to book?
And there seems no doubt that no matter whether they decide to do it for some movies and not all movies, it's still going to mean that a tougher business for theater owners, and that's for sure.
I absolutely think you're right. And I think you look at theaters now and say, is that tomorrow's blockbuster, meaning the video store? Is how long is their future?
But don't you think people always want to go out, always want
to
go out to the movies?
If you release a movie on DVD and on video on demand and it's in theaters, a lot of people are going to say, I don't want to go see Transformers on my TV. I want to go with a crowd, or a genre movie like Paranormal Activity. You have to see that movie with an audience because it's a totally different experience than seeing it at home. So yeah, I think it will happen, but I don't know. It just feels like an antiquity of exhibition that doesn't make any sense anymore.
Now let's move from the theaters to a theater owner, which would be Sumner Redstone, who said he was going to sell his theaters, the head of Viacom, but now it turns out he's not.
Well, how many buyers were there? I mean, this is exactly what we're talking about. I mean, you're trying to sell Hummers when everybody else is buying Priuses. I just don't see the viability of selling of a theater, and maybe that's why he couldn't sell them.
Well, he
also said he was not going to sell a single share of his stock, and he was only off by, what, 50 million shares?
He's selling a lot of shares in his stock. And this leads into an interview that we have coming up in the show about moguls and their control. He is not yielding control. He's lucky because the stock in his companies, the value of them went up as the market rose. And therefore, he was under a crushing debt problem. And he has managed to dodge a bullet that I think many investors were hoping would hit him, because they don't believe that Sumner Redstone at this point is the greatest steward of these assets at Viacom and CBS, which are the, you know, make up his company. He has dodged that bullet, and his company owns 6-7% of Viacom now and controls it, which is really
phenomenal. Are you saying, Kim, that you can't be an 86-year-old visionary? I think this is getting into ageist territory.
You know, many times he's been asked about succession and said he doesn't plan to die, and apparently he really meant it. And I think that is all the news that is fit for bantering. So thank you, John.
Thank you, Kim.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. Modern-day media moguls, from Sumner Redstone to Rupert Murdoch, seem to hold unbridled power over their companies. In a new book, investment banker and Columbia Business School professor Jonathan Nee argues that their business decisions often serve their egos instead of their shareholders. The book is The Curse of the Mogul: What's Wrong with the World's Leading Media Companies? We reached Nee in his office in New York. So when you define mogul, what are you talking about here?
Well, in general, I would say what defines a mogul is being all-powerful having the ability to have plenary authority over your domain. And there are moguls in other industries than media, but what makes media a little different is that, much more so than any other industry, there are structural reasons why the people in charge can do whatever the hell they like.
Regardless of whether they actually own the company that they're running or not.
Certainly regardless of whether they own a controlling economic stake. In the media industry, there is a tradition of having the owner mogul have disproportionate voting control to their actual economic control. So there have even been cases where the economic control is as little as 1, 2, or 3%, but they have absolute control over the direction of the company.
Now, you list in your book, which is kind of funny for a serious work, you have a chart of tests to assess regular executives, I guess, and for media moguls. And for example, economic tests to assess would be consistently superior profitability, and media mogul tests to assess you have good table at Spago, invited to Sun Valley, and CEO compensation levels, which are quite different from normal tests of success.
Indeed. Well, it's a joke on the one hand, but on the other hand, part of the problem is people have all kinds of different notions as to what the criteria for success is. And sometimes people think the criteria should be the personal perks and adulation that comes with the business. Sometimes it's more aesthetic. You know, did you get a lot of Oscars or Emmys? But my view is there's actually even a moral issue here. To the extent that you are going to go out and get people to invest in your company, I think it's reasonable that they should assume that you are going to try to act as a fiduciary for their interests. And the only way to do that is by applying sort of basic economic principles. I think there's a deeper issue, though, too, which is that part of how moguls have gotten away with what they have is that they have managed to convince people that somehow those principles shouldn't really apply to them, precisely because the nature of the underlying businesses involve creative talent and requires some kind of very special magic sauce to do, and that that these silly notions of efficient operations really can't be applied to them. And that would explain why even in some of the big companies, the board seem to let the management do whatever the heck they want. And in fact, the worst cases of value destruction, which were the AOL Time Warner transaction by far, was not a case of a company where the mogul had actual control through special shares or otherwise, but it was just somebody who clearly held his board in total sway, and that board somehow felt that they should just let him do whatever he wanted.
That would be Jerry Levin, of course,
at
Time Warner.
That would have been Jerry Levin, yes.
Who then just almost destroyed his company with this irrational acquisition.
And you wrote about Michael Eisner, and clearly the last 5 or so years of the Eisner reign were something close to mad. And the board.
You know, I was hard on him, but I don't know if I used that exact turn of phrase.
You know, I mean,
go ahead.
But the fact that the board let go on in those last years, everything that went on, which was really, they treated him as if he actually did control the company. Would you say that was book?
Yes,
in
absolutely.
Jim Stewart's book?
Mm-hmm.
You would think that he was not an employee. He was somebody who they felt the company literally couldn't operate without, and that they just kind of had to let him pick his successor, do whatever he want, make whatever kind of deal with Ovitz he wanted, that they had no choice but to let him. And of course, they did have a choice.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Jonathan Nee, whose new book is The Curse of the Mogul: What's Wrong with the World's Leading Media Companies? So what your argument here is that there should be kind of a rational analysis applied to the performance of these companies, which seems fair enough. And you do talk in terms of, does a company have a competitive advantage?
Exactly.
Criteria that makes sense. But it seems to me that Hollywood attracts people who don't necessarily care about competitive advantage. They just want to compete. And if they don't have an advantage, that makes it more fun. I'm going to quote you from your own book. Businesses that attract the greatest mogul interests seem to have the fewest competitive advantages. And it seems to me, I'm saying, that's the nature of moguls. They want to come out there on the level field and prove that they're better than, smarter than, richer than everybody else.
It's sad but true. But I guess when you say better than, the notion that better than is beating, in the vernacular sense, that is, I paid the most for Julia Roberts. I paid the most for the NFL. You win, but your stock price is going to go into the tank. I mean, the way to be a winner in businesses with either no competitive advantage or where several companies share the same competitive advantage is by cooperating. And it's not necessary in the nature of this business that you can't cooperate. In the Lou Wasserman era, Lou Wasserman was the person who kind of set the tone for the industry and created an atmosphere and aura of cooperation. Everybody knew it was in their interest not to bid away stars, not to engage in self-destructive behavior. He was a great mogul, but he didn't need to kick everybody in the teeth and show that he was a big shot.
Of course, he was the person who created MCA, Universal, and in a way is cited as a model of a mogul in your book, I think, right?
Exactly. And so you can go to a lot of premieres and get a lot of swag without being so destructive to the shareholders as the current crop has. And I would say the other thing that's kind of unfortunate, and the last line of my book, is that shareholders get the moguls they deserve, but there's a weird kind of adulation even that comes with these behaviors that destroy value. I mean, if you ask the average person, you know, what did Rupert Murdoch do that was brilliant with the Fox network, they will almost uniformly say when he stole away the NFL rights from CBS. And that made the Fox network. Well, the reality is, not only did he overpay for that, and even if you take into account the extra spillover effects for the rest of the network that having the sports did, none of that can possibly compensate for what it did to basically end the previous era of cooperation amongst the networks, where nobody bid away anything from anybody. And after that happened, it wasn't just that football rights became outrageously expensive. Every sports right became outrageously expensive. It's true that it helped the overall ratings of Fox, but it didn't help the profitability of either Fox or the rest of the industry. And in fact, it accelerated what has now become a rapid decline of the profitability of the broadcasting industry.
One of the things that you talk about in your book is the role of the internet. And you mentioned Bob Iger at Disney, and you talk about a sort of a cringe-inducing desire on his part to appear to be part of the 21st century and internet savvy and hip. And certainly it appears that that Disney it has an interest in being online with, you know, they've been a supporter of Hulu. Is Bob Iger in danger of a trap that moguls fall into?
Well, look, Bob Iger is not any more or less guilty than anybody else who's in a traditional media business. When you look longingly at some businesses that appear to be growing and have high margins and your business is having trouble getting growth, you know, I have sympathy for that. Hulu, though, I would say is at least potentially a good sign in that even though it took them far longer than it should, it at least now is a largely cooperative venture between the major studios. And part of the problem, as we talked about earlier, with mogul behavior is a self-destructive instinct to want to go it alone and be the biggest and be the best. And where you're facing the kinds of challenges that are being faced here, doing things cooperatively make a lot more sense.
So although you've touched on Hulu, which is the one I get the least,
because
I don't understand how giving away content helps these companies.
So there are two. Look, I believe in baby steps. Each of you competing with each other to give away more free content is the worst of all possible worlds. At least creating a single platform provides the opportunity to start behaving a little more rationally about what's given away and what's not given away.
Now, who do you think would be the most overrated mogul out there? Can you tell us that? And the most undervalued?
A standout that I cite in the book is Discovery Communications. It is a cable channel business. They brought in a new CEO a couple of years ago, David Zaslav, who got them out of a bunch of crazy, extraneous things like stores and retail and things, and has managed to increase their margins 10% in a couple of years. And David Zaslav is a great example of an underrated executive.
When we return in a minute, we'll continue our discussion about how media moguls may be hurting their investors with their alpha male behavior. You're listening to The Business from KCRW. We'd love to know what you think. Write us at thebusiness@kcrw.com or go to the comment page for today's show at kcrw.com/thebusiness. the Business, and I'm Kim Masters. In Jonathan Nee's new book, The Curse of the Mogul, he and his co-authors argue that modern-day media moguls are sometimes so irrationally competitive that they hurt their own businesses. But not every media mogul is guilty of such wretched excess. Nee just told us that one of his most admired CEOs is David Zaslav of Discovery Communications. We asked him to size up a higher profile and more controversial mogul. I see ambivalence in your writing about Rupert Murdoch.
Yes. You know, Murdoch has a fascinating mixture of brilliant strategic moves and mad follies. And the net impact in terms of his share price has been that he kind of underperforms the market. But he underperforms it less than everybody else because many of the others don't have the virtue of at least some of the brilliant moves. And when he's brilliant, he understands, even though he's the only really global business of all these big media companies, it's not really a global business. It's a multi-local business. And he understands that you need to understand the local business well.
What about Sumner Redstone? I would imagine he's at the other end of the spectrum at this point.
Well, you know, look, the curse of the mogul of the title here is that all of these folks started doing exactly the opposite of what they say is their strategy now. So they started with intensely local businesses that were not content-based or did not rely on stars and were not high-tech at all. So he ran an incredibly efficient, and it's still efficient today, Northeastern movie theater company. Those are the kinds of businesses that have high barriers to entry that generate huge cash flow, and you get into trouble when you take that cash flow and you go to your first premiere, I guess, and the rest, unfortunately for the shareholders, is often history.
Jonathan Nee is Senior Managing Director at Evercore Partners and an adjunct professor and director of the media program at Columbia Business School. He's co-author of the new book, The Curse of the Mogul, What's Wrong with the World's Leading Media Companies. And thank you so much for talking to us today.
Thank you so much, Kim. Take care.
Among the breakout shows of this new TV season is NCIS Los Angeles, a spin-off of the popular procedural drama NCIS. That's the show based on the real-life Naval Criminal Investigative Service. The new show is drawing ratings that are hard to come by in this fractured entertainment environment, but the show came out of the gate with a big head start because the original NCIS was in its seventh season with a massive following. NCIS followed an unusual trajectory for a network show. It actually grew the longer it was on the air, thanks in part to the people who discovered it in repeats on the USA Network. By the time CBS asked executive producer Shane Brennan about a spinoff, he'd already been thinking about how to make it work. So when you decide, okay, we're going to go for it and we're going to do the spinoff, how do you figure out what elements to keep that are make it recognizable as an NCIS spinoff and what has to be completely different?
The first 4 years, it had a fairly consistent 13 or 14 million people watching it, and they were hardcore viewers. And it became very apparent to me that to make a spin-off that just copied the original was a recipe for disaster, because that fan base were always going to compare the new characters and the new show with the show that they loved. And these fans love this show. They really love it. You get on the CBS forum for NCIS, and you can see how much it is in their lives. So to me, it was very important to win them over. And so it becomes very important to get the character mix in the new show right. Now, the fact that they're both NCIS, procedurally, they tend to operate the same way. They work for the same agency.
You have Chris O'Donnell and LL Cool J, sort of a buddy thing going on in the Los Angeles show. And was that deliberately just trying to step away from a more maybe hierarchical, like boss plus servant thing?
I was looking for that. It was my intention to let that grow over the first season. The reality is when Chris and LL Cool J got together, the chemistry was instant. The interesting thing about the whole process of creating a television show is that it is always changing. You reach a point where the original idea you have about the show, it's going to change anyway because there are so many elements that come into it. And the biggest one of those, of course, is the cast, the input that they bring. And by, you know, 8-10 episodes in, the show has changed. And it finds its own level. It becomes its own entity. it's a hard thing to actually to explain, but it comes to life. It creates its own place. And as much as anything, you kind of end up going along for the ride.
As you move forward, if you want to adjust, you're quite a bit ahead of where you are with what we see on the network versus what you're actually working on. So you have to wait to make changes.
Well, that's always the difficulty when you make television. There's a certain amount of forward planning. There's a certain amount of production time you need and post-production time. So when a program airs, say it's airing as episode 3, we may be in production on episode 8 and we may be scripting episode 12. So if there's something the audience suddenly decide they don't like, a character or a character relationship or a type of story, we have to sit here and chew our fingernails for 7 or 8 episodes before the audience will see a change.
Is there anything you could say that you wanted to tweak or will want to tweak that you can you tip your hand at all?
There are a couple of biggish ones coming up. But to my mind, they're all responding to what I believe the audience is looking for and what the network believes the audience is looking for.
And again, so is that based on focus groups or what's the feedback that you get to guide you?
The shows are tested from time to time. One of the really great things about this century is the internet and the instant feedback you get.
Right.
On NCIS forums, for instance, there are actually people who sit there and will watch the show and they will write about it as they watch it. So it's instant feedback for those people who can't watch. And then there are thousands of postings over the course of a week responding to last week's show. Now, once again, you have to be a little careful about that. These are fans who watched the show and have watched it from day
right.
one.
They're sort of
so
diehard.
They're the diehard fans. So you can't do everything they want. But you can test the water. If 9 out of 10 of them say, you know what, we didn't really like that kind of military story you did. Okay, we won't do that one again. But it takes us a time to actually make that adjustment.
Do you think that if you had just taken this show and not called it NCIS Los Angeles, you would have been able to launch it in this environment? Or does it have to be a spin-off to have that head start in this incredibly fragmented world that we're in now?
From where I sit right now, thank goodness that it was a spin-off, because we had 18 million people ready to watch it. Any new show that is being created, it opens in a vacuum. The audience know nothing about it. Okay, they've seen the publicity, they've seen the posters, but at the end of the day, they don't know what it's like. They've got to sit there and watch it.
And how hard is that today?
Yeah, and how hard is that today?
When you see Southland canceled on NBC, do you think, oh my God, I'm so happy I have this known entity that I can work with, because it really is a pretty tough world out there.
It is very tough. And I watched Southland and I thought it was fabulous. But in certain economic times, in certain phases of our history, some shows work better than others. NCIS and NCIS Los Angeles both rely heavily on humor. And in bad economic times, it's good to be able to sit down in front of the television, turn it on, and shut off the world. I have no illusions about what we're making. We're making, for an audience out there, we're giving them the chance to just sit back and lose themselves. It's escapist television. It's pure entertainment.
Shane Brennan is executive producer of NCIS and NCIS Los Angeles. We spoke with him at his offices on the Paramount lot. Thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
And that's The Business. Darby Maloney produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. Matt Holzman is the producer of the show. Our theme music mashup was designed by beat architect Jason Grohman. The Business is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica. If you have any questions or comments about the show, write us at thebusiness@kcrw.com. You can also listen to this or any past program and comment about the show at kcrw.com/thebusiness. You can listen to our podcast, share it with a friend, or embed it on your blog with a click of the button from our new media player at kcrw.com. And you can always subscribe to the podcast through iTunes. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.